Iran and Oman assigned several memorandums of understanding and cooperation programs in sectors including oil and gas and transportation during the Iranian president's visit to Muscat. Moscow has accused the West of triggering a global food crisis as a result of anti-Russia sanctions. And China warns the U.S. that it has no room for compromise or concessions on matters related to its sovereignty or territorial integrity. Hello, everyone. Very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is in Oman on an official visit where expansion of bilateral cooperation tops his agenda. Raisi was welcomed by Oman Sultan Haytham bin Tariq at his official Al Alam Palace. Following Raisi's arrival, Iran and Oman signed 12 cooperation documents and memorandums of understanding. These include cooperation in energy, transportation, industrial, and trade sectors. Documents were signed by a number of Iranian ministers, including top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian and their Omani counterparts. Raisi's trip to Muscat is part of the Iranian government's efforts to strengthen ties with neighboring countries. Earlier, we were joined by chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Speaking prior to his trip to Oman, Iran's president ordered a serious investigation into the assassination of a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. Ebrahim Raisi has pledged to avenge the killing of Colonel Sayed Khodai. Raisi said arrogant world powers were involved in the crime. IRGC, a colonel, was assassinated in his car in front of his home in Tehran on Sunday. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. Iran's foreign ministry has described the assassination as a terrorist operation and an inhumane crime. The ministry said it is regrettable to see countries claiming to be fighting terrorism silent on this assassination. Russia has accused the West of triggering a global food crisis by imposing the severest sanctions on Russia over its military operations in Ukraine.
We are not the source of the problem. The source of the problem that leads to world hunger are those who impose sanctions against us and the sanctions themselves.
The Kremlin spokesman also blamed Ukraine for making commercial shipping impossible by mining its waters. Peskov underlined Russia has not shut off Ukraine's grain exports to Poland despite Western weapons being delivered to Kiev. A UN Food Agency official had previously said more than 25 million tons of grain was stuck in Ukraine due to lack of infrastructure and a sea blockade. More than 36 countries are now facing food insecurity issues as they rely heavily on wheat imports from Russia and Ukraine. Ongoing war and the West's anti-Russia measures have pushed up prices of commodities ranging from cooking oil and fertilizer to energy in many countries. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for maximum sanctions against Russia, including an oil embargo over the Ukraine war.
This is what the sanctions should be. There should be maximum so that Russia and every other potential aggressor who wants to wage a brutal war against its neighbor would clearly know the immediate consequences for their actions. And I believe there's still no such sanctions against Russia. And there should be. There should be Russian oil embargo. All the Russian banks should be blocked. No exceptions. There should be an abandonment of the Russian IT sector. There should not be any trade with Russia. This should be a precedent for sanctions pressure that will work convincingly for the decades to come.
Zelensky issued the call during a virtual speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He urged all foreign businesses still operating in Russia to immediately withdraw from there and instead put their money into rebuilding Ukraine. Zelensky also called for more arms supplies to Ukraine, saying that Kiev needs all the weapons that it's asked for, not just the ones that have been provided. Western countries, spearheaded by Washington, have been pouring billions of dollars in military assistance into Ukraine since Russia began its military operation in late February. They've also imposed several rounds of sanctions against Moscow. In response, Russia has blacklisted hundreds of Western individuals and diplomats. An exclusive report, our correspondent in Ukraine, Johnny Miller, investigates the alleged single most deadly war crime of the conflict so far.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theater.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement. He wouldn't speak on camera, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me, just over there, is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
And now China has lashed out at the U.S. after President Joe Biden said that Washington will defend Taiwan militarily if Beijing invades the self-ruled island.
We deplore and reject the U.S. remarks. Taiwan is an inimitable part of the Chinese territory. The Taiwan issue is purely China's internal affair, which won't stand for any foreign interference. Issues bearing on China's core interests, including the sovereignty and territorial integrity, there's no room for compromise or concession. No one should underestimate the Chinese people's firm resolution, will, and capability to defend its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and should not stand against the 1.4 billion Chinese people.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman also called on the U.S. to earnestly abide by the One China principle and refrain from supporting Taiwan's independence. The official warned Washington that its meddlesome approach will harm bilateral ties. China has time and again warned the U.S. against increasing military and political support for Taiwan. China considers the island as part of its territory. At least five people are dead after sections of an unfinished building collapse in southwestern Iran. Some 27 people have so far been pulled out from under rubble and taken to area hospitals. A 10-story structure came down at around midday in downtown Abadan. Search and rescue efforts are underway. There are fears the number of casualties will rise, with reports saying up to 50 people are still trapped under debris. The collapse took place and blocked the city's busiest road, with surrounding buildings evacuated. An investigation is underway to determine the cause of this collapse. The building owner and contractor have both been detained. In Australia, Labor leader Anthony Albanese has been sworn in as Prime Minister, ending nearly a decade of Conservative-led rule in the country. Albanese and four of his ministers took the oath of office after his party won national elections Saturday. Albanese takes the helm hours before a summit in Tokyo with Japanese, Indian, and U.S. leaders as part of the so-called Quad Group. He said the summit is an absolute priority for his country and an opportunity to send a message of change to the world. He said he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish in policy terms.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together, look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks.
Australia's new Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has vowed to mend Canberra's relations with the world and sweep aside the country's reputation as a climate damager. Albanese has also said he will unite the country, especially due to anger over climate change after some of the worst floods and fires hit the country in recent months.
Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As outlined in the Queen's speech, Conservatives are set to bring forward legislation to ban public bodies from participating in BDS campaigns. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kamel Hawash, chair of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, in an article published under the heading Zionist Regime. Anti-boycott bill threatens British democracy. Here's the story. The recent announcement in the Queen's speech on the government's plan to ban public bodies from participating in boycott campaigns, under the pretext that such activity would undermine community cohesion, has been on the cards since the 2019 election campaign, when the Conservatives pledged to do exactly that. This policy is driven by a desire to protect the Zionist regime from the peaceful Palestinian boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS campaign. Despite claiming that BDS is largely ineffective, the fabricated regime of Israel is spending millions of dollars on efforts to combat the movement. Its past actions have included banning foreign boycott activists from entering the occupied territories and pushing U.S. states to adopt anti-boycott laws that punish firms for practicing BDS. In 2015, Boris Johnson, then the mayor of London, derided British supporters of BDS as corduroy-jacketed, snaggle-toothed, lefty academics, Michael Gove, another high-profile conservative politician, said in 2016 that the campaign to boycott the fabricated regime of Israel was a crime worse than apartheid. Numerous human rights groups have since confirmed that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against the Palestinian population. Today, in Johnson's government, Gove will oversee Britain's fight against BDS. He will be shadowed in the Labour opposition by Lisa Nandy, who has previously spoken out against the boycott movement. Last week's announcement in the Queen's speech followed a parliamentary vote in February to ban boycott of the Zionist regime in public pension funds, severely curbing the rights of fund administrators to have their ethical views taken into account when investing. The Zionist propaganda routinely accuses BDS supporters of being anti-Semitic, a claim that has no basis when the movement's demands are examined. BDS calls for the implementation of basic Palestinian rights, including an end to the Israeli regime occupation, equal treatment for all citizens, and respecting the right of return for Palestinian refugees. These demands are not only legal and peaceful, but also ethical. The BDS movement does not pose any threat to Jewish communities around the world. The community cohesion argument does not hold water. How does a movement calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against a foreign state impact communities in the U.S.? The drive to implement an anti-boycott policy suggests that Britain will never hold the fabricated regime of Israel to account for its crimes, for fear it could upset the Jewish community in the U.S. It is worth noting here that members of the Jewish community hold different views on the Zionist regime, and many have a strong objections to Israel's apartheid policies and oppression of Palestinians. Indeed, the BDS movement should prompt members of Jewish communities who claim to have an affinity with the Zionist regime to question its recent appalling history and repeated violations of Palestinian rights, including through the 2018 nation-state law, which codifies superior rights for Jewish citizens and paves the way for further Zionist annexation of Palestinian land. Following on from the Queen's speech, the Conservatives appear committed to bringing an anti-BDS bill to Parliament soon. Yet, considering Britain's championing of sanctions against Moscow over the Russia-Ukraine tension, the government may find it challenging to land on wording that curtails boycotts of the fabricated regime of Israel while allowing them for other countries. Palestinian activists and other social justice campaigners have been aware that this was coming, and they have been organizing for some time. Last month, dozens of groups united to launch a website and issue a statement warning against the proposed legislation and calling on the government to back away from it. They labeled the partnership Right to Boycott. While last week's announcement makes clear that activists have not convinced the government to drop its anti-BDS quest, the focus now shifts to ensuring the related law does not pass. Parliamentarians across party lines will need to do much soul-searching in the coming days, asking themselves whether curtailing democratic rights is a fair price to pay for maintaining political relations with the Zionist regime. Holding a massive majority in Parliament, the British government can potentially pass any legislation it chooses unless there is a backbench rebellion. In this case, such a rebellion could be triggered by the legitimate fear that the anti-boycott bill would further erode democratic rights in the UK. British MPs should stand on the right side of history and not only defeat this bill, but financially put an end to the double standards when it comes to the Palestinian people, and ensure that the Zionist regime is held accountable for his crimes.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we're going to be addressing a very, very important spiritual disease. So, the disease you and I are going to talk about is one which is called in Arabic su'udhan. It's when we think badly of others. There's different words that we might use in English. I'm suspicious. I have inclinations. I have intuition. Right? We're going to, inshallah, take a little bit of a deep dive into this and find out why it is that it happens. Right? But there's sometimes when I, as a believer, somebody does something and it crosses my mind that this person is up to no good. Right? Su'udhan. The problem is this. Without hujjah, without Islamic proof, when you and I arrive at a conclusion about someone and make a judgment about someone, now I've thought badly of that person because I don't have hujjah. Whereas Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran and Surah Hujarat, Allah tells us this as believers. He says, اجتنبوا كثيرا من الظن. Avoid my suspicion, thinking badly of others. إن بعض الظن إثم. Truly, some of these suspicions, these thinkings, this feeling towards other believers is definitely a sin. When Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to get believers, us, because these ahadith are for us, to us to avoid it for him, you're going to see the argument of Imam Ali. Once God has said you shouldn't think this way about believers, that's enough for Imam Ali. Listen to this hadith. The Imam tells us this. اطرحوا سوء الظن. Cast aside. Make sure you never think this way about other believers. Why? فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلْ نَهَى عَنْ ذَلِكَ. Allah said don't be that way. Allah wants you to think good of believers. That's enough for Imam Ali. Now what happens is, even though God has spoken, and that should be it for the believers, sometimes you'll find that a believer will read the tea leaves. I'll put two and two together. I see what this person did or said. I come to a conclusion. Is that hujjah between you and Allah? Because we'll talk about that later. No, I don't have hujjah that I can feel this way about this believer. But still, I'm like, I don't like this person. I don't think good of this person. Or I suspect their actions. This person is up to no good. I'm going to try and give some practical examples for us to see this. Right? Whereas Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to create a society, a world, a civilization where the believers all think good of one another. Normally, when a believer sees one another, we're all supposed to be assuming the best about a believer. That famous story that I mentioned that happened in the early history of Islam. It's the story which is called Ifk in the Quran. So Surah Nur. Then I'm going to be quoting verse number 12. But if you look over there in Surah Nur, you'll see that Allah goes over this issue in detail. Very important points over there. I want to explain part of it. The summary of the story is this. Because there's even a difference a little bit among Shia and Sunni. How were the details? But that's not the point. We can still get that lesson that we're supposed to get from this. What happens was that after one of the battles, the Muslims were coming back from the battle. And one of the Prophet's wives ended up not making it with the caravan. Maybe she was sleeping. Maybe she did something. The caravan moved, and she was left behind. And one of the brothers ended up seeing her. She's by herself. So he goes over, and he brings her. They come late. They arrive late. And what happened was certain people started rumors. Why is the prophet's wife late? Who's that guy? What's their relationship? They started these rumors. Su'udhan, thinking badly, I don't have hujjah. They started this. The ayat of the Quran, if you look in Surah, very severe. Allah was very severe about this. I just want to mention one of them that kind of illustrates the point that we're trying to take for the beginning of the lecture. So when some people started repeating, unfortunately, those different words, thinking in this way, su'udhan, see what God says. This is Surah 12, or 24, but 12. God says this. Lawla idh sami'tumuhu. Why was it, God's very severe in this. Why was it that when you heard this, dhanna al-mu'minun wal-mu'minat bi-anfusihim khayra, that the first response of the mu'mineen and mu'minat was that they think good of each other. The general instruction of Islam, a society which is built on assuming the best. Why wasn't that the first reaction or the first response from the believers? Why didn't the believers, the verse continues, why didn't the believers, waqalu, why didn't the believers say this? Hada ifkum mubin. When they heard this, even despite seeing, reading the tea leaves, the prophet's wife, she's left, there's a young man, why did, instead of doing that, why didn't they say that this is a big lie? Why wasn't that the first response? Why wasn't it the case that the believers first thought good of each other, first assumed what was right? Right? To assume that I have no right to repeat this. I shouldn't be thinking like this. Now, a couple of questions. The first question, brothers and sisters, is when is it? Because I think all of us can say, meaning as human beings, there are times when somebody might do something or say something. We have an interaction with someone which is less than pleasant, and sometimes a whisper creeps into our mind. Right? We might have had that experience. So when is it that it becomes haram? That this is, because the Quran said that some of these thoughts are definitely ha'if, a sin. When is it that it's a sin? I want to give three scenarios. The first one, this is according to all maraja. It does not, you know, I follow the, you know, all maraja. First, if we develop bad thoughts about a Muslim, for whatever reason, a Muslim did something, bad thoughts about that Muslim, I don't have hujjah to be able to say, no, this is something which is unjustifiable. This is a situation I must take a stance. I don't have that hujjah. And either, one of two things, my behavior changes towards this Muslim. Something happened, but now there's a visible change in my behavior towards this believer. Or what else have the maraja said? Or no, my words change. The way I address the believer. Before, the conversations would be a certain way. One was behavior, maybe I'm less, not the same smile, that's the first one. But then the second one is, no, this isn't real. There's sometimes when a believer will do or say something, and a thought will come to my mind. A whisper will come from shaitan. The person, they didn't answer, I texted, they didn't answer immediately. Different. Somebody called, they didn't pick up. I asked for a loan, they didn't help. Different scenarios that come up, and that whisper did come from shaitan. That thought did cross my heart that this believer is trying to be malicious. But I didn't change my behavior, and I'm upset that I feel this way. I don't like that I crossed my heart. This believer did this. It crossed my heart. I don't like that. I didn't change my behavior. And actually, I'm actively trying to fight this. I don't want to think badly of a mu'min or mu'mina. If I'm doing this one, this is definitely not a sin. I haven't changed my behavior. A whisper, that's not even in my hands, shaitani whispers, it came in my mind, and I'm actively trying to fight it. This one is not a sin. The third one's a little bit scary, though. This one, according to some, meaning some of our scholars have arrived at the conclusion, we'll have to see with this one. But the third one is this.
I think badly of a Muslim. I do think badly of a Muslim. I don't have hujjah. When it comes a hadith from the imam, I don't have hujjah. I don't have proof for this to be able to say, on yawm al-qiyamah, I took this stance. Allah wa-. No, I don't have that. At the same time, I don't feel bad. Remember, in the second scenario, I feel bad. Why is it that I feel this way about another believer? I don't like that. Right? And this one, the third scenario, no. I haven't changed my behavior. I might still smile. I'm bright. I'm friendly. But I'm qalban. I don't like this Muslim. That's the one we have to be scary about. According to some, they say that this is su'udhan. I thought badly of a Muslim.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Georgia, United States, David Perdue challenged Governor Brian Kemp because of Donald Trump's fury over his 2020 election loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Shane Goldmacher. The piece is titled, Perdue Had Trump. In Georgia, Kemp Had Everything Else. In September of 2021, former Senator David Perdue was hemming and hawing about running for governor of Georgia. Over dinner with an old friend on Sea Island, he pulled out his iPhone and showed the list of calls he'd gotten from Donald J. Trump, lobbying him to take the plunge. He said Donald Trump called him all the time, said Martha Zoller, a former aide to Mr. Perdue, who now hosts a talk radio show in Gainesville, Georgia. Martha Zoller added, he showed me on his iPhone these multiple recent calls and said they were from the former president. Martha Zoller and a legion of other former Perdue aides and advisers told the former senator that running was a bad idea. He listened to Donald Trump instead. Now David Perdue is staring down an epic defeat at the hands of Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican whom Donald Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss more than any other person. The Perdue campaign is ending the race low on cash with no advertisements on television and a candidate described even by his supporters as lackluster and distracted. Perdue thought that Trump was a magic wand, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and a Trump ally, who was among David Perdue's highest profile Georgia supporters. In retrospect, it's hard to understand David Perdue's campaign, and it's certainly not the campaign those of us who were for him expected. Mr. Perdue's impending downfall in Tuesday's primary for governor in Georgia looms as the biggest electoral setback for Donald Trump since his own defeat in the 2020 presidential election. There is perhaps no contest in which the former president has done more to try to influence the outcome. Mr. Trump recruited, promoted, and cleared the field for his ally while assailing Brian Kemp, recording television advertisements and giving $2.64 million to groups helping David Perdue, by far the most he has ever invested in another politician. Yet the race has exposed the limits of Donald Trump's sway, especially against entrenched Republican incumbents. David Perdue's failures were not just of his own making. He was outflanked by a savvy incumbent in Brian Kemp, who exploited the powers of his office to cut off David Perdue from allies, including Mr. Perdue's own cousin, Sonny, a former governor and Trump agriculture secretary, whom Brian Kemp's allies appointed chancellor of the university system of Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp also appeared to punish those who crossed him. One congressional seat was drawn to exclude the home of a candidate whose father, a Perdue supporter, had publicly criticized the governor. And he offered goodies to voters, including a gas tax holiday that conveniently runs through to the end of May, just past the primary. On Thursday, 19th of May, as David Perdue campaigned outside the Semper Fi Bar and Grill in Woodstock, Georgia, he was not conjuring up a path to victory, but haggling over the scope of his widely expected defeat after a Fox News Channel survey showed him down 32 percentage points on his rival. "Hell no, I'm not down 30 points," insisted David Perdue, whose campaign did not respond to requests for comment for this article. "We may not win on Tuesday," he added, "but I will guarantee you we are not down 30 points. The key threshold on Tuesday is 50%. Brian Kemp must win an outright majority in the five-candidate field to avoid a one-on-one runoff in June." The story of David Perdue's efforts is less one of political collapse and more of a failure to launch. From the moment he announced his candidacy in December, Mr. Perdue never demonstrated the same commitment to winning that he displayed in his first Senate race back in 2014. His case for ousting Brian Kemp was always largely based on support from the former president, Donald Trump. Mr. Perdue argued at his campaign introduction that the governor had so alienated the party's Trump faithful that they would not rally around Mr. Kemp against Stacey Abrams, the presumptive Democratic nominee and a leading villain for Republicans. But Mr. Perdue, a 72-year-old, a wealthy former chief executive of Dollar General, never came close to matching the $3.8 million of his own money he put into his 2014 Senate race. He invested just $500,000 in his bid for governor of Georgia. That is less than he and his wife spent last year for a waterfront lot on a secluded peninsula on scenic St. Simon's Island, a purchase made not long after his runoff defeat at the hands of a then 33-year-old Democrat that delivered Senate control to Democrats. A permit to build a nearly 12,000-square-feet mansion worth an estimated $5 million on land including over 625 feet of lake frontage. According to the listing, was granted 2 weeks after he declared his candidacy, according to records. Donald Trump has simultaneously invested heavily in Mr. Perdue with his $2.64 million and sought to avoid blame as the candidate has faltered, telling the New York Times in April that the news media's focus should be on the endorsements, not the David Perdue one, to measure his influence. Donald Trump's last rally in Georgia came in late March. He did not return to Georgia, as Perdue allies had hoped, instead holding a conference call for supporters in early May. "I am with David all the way because Brian Kemp was the worst governor in the country on election integrity," Donald Trump insisted on Friday on his Truth Social messaging platform. David Perdue, like candidates for governor in Idaho and Nebraska this month, learned that a Trump endorsement does not assure the support of Trump voters or Trump donors. "The Trump endorsement is very important, but it's only an endorsement," said former Representative Jack Kingston, who lost the 2014 Senate primary to David Perdue and is a former Trump advisor. "It's not an army of infrastructure and door knockers the way it would be if you have the Sierra Club or the NRA or the AFL-CIO. The juxtaposition between the Kemp and Perdue camps was particularly stark on Friday. Mr. Kemp was outside Savannah, Georgia, announcing that Hyundai was investing $5.5 billion in an electric battery and vehicle manufacturing plant, one of the largest economic development projects in Georgia's history. David Perdue was nearby holding an endorsement event with Sarah Palin, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee, who is making her own comeback attempt in a House race in Alaska. "I would rather be standing on the stage announcing 7,500 jobs than standing next to Sarah Palin," said Brian Kemp's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a fierce Trump critic who opted not to run for re-election this year. Randy Evans, a Perdue supporter who served as ambassador to Luxembourg in the Trump administration, said the Kemp operation had been ruthless in using what he called the bullying powers of the governorship. Randy Evans' son, Jake, is running for Congress in the Atlanta suburbs. "When Kemp-aligned Republican legislators drew new lines in redistricting, the younger Mr. Evans was suddenly drawn out of the district in which he had been planning to run. They cut a sliver about the size of your little finger," the elder Mr. Evans said. "Jake had to move, buy a new house." Brian Kemp, a 58-year-old, leveraged the powers of incumbency in other crucial ways. He signed the measure to provide tax refunds of up to $500 for married couples, then announced on 11th of May, after early voting had begun, that those checks were in the mail. He appealed to rural Georgians by raising pay for teachers and pleased conservatives by signing sweeping legislation to restrict voting access, to expand gun rights, and forbid school mask mandates. David Perdue's efforts could seem feeble in comparison. In March, he attacked Brian Kemp for recruiting an electric truck maker to open a factory in rural Georgia, creating thousands of jobs, because George Soros, the prominent Democratic donor, had recently invested in the company. The Kemp-Perdue contest was steeped in the drama of personal betrayal. Brian Kemp had spent weeks campaigning with David Perdue before the senator's defeat in the January 2021 Senate runoff election. By then, Brian Kemp had infuriated Donald Trump by defending the legitimacy of Georgia's presidential results. Last spring, Brian Kemp's aide said David Perdue assured Brian Kemp that he did not intend to run for governor. That June, Mr. Perdue introduced the governor at the Georgia Republican Party's annual convention. But Brian Kemp, Kennedy, had already begun the process of installing Sonny Perdue, a popular former governor, to run Georgia's state universities, an appointment that effectively put him on the sidelines. Sonny Perdue, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Brian Kemp also preemptively secured the loyalty and fundraising might of Alec Poitvent, a South Georgia businessman who had served as campaign chairman for David Perdue's Senate campaigns and Sonny Perdue's campaigns for governor. One of many ways, the Brian Kemp operation boxed out David Perdue financially. Mr. Poitvent said he was among a host of longtime David Perdue supporters who had urged him not to run. Shunned by the state's political establishment, David Perdue tried framing himself as a political outsider. "I've been an outsider since I got into politics," he said on Thursday. But that is a difficult case to make for a former senator boasting of his support from a former president.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. You people of Palestine, you self-sacrificing youth in the West Bank and in the 1948 lands, you who are struggling for God in the Jenin refugee camp, and you, the residents in the Palestinian camps outside of Palestine, are important, sensitive parts and pioneers of the resistance. Greetings be upon you, Know that, verily Allah will defend those who believe. This is verse of Quran, chapter 22, verse 38. But if you are patient, it will certainly be best for those who are patient. Chapter 16, verse 126. But if you persevere patiently and guard against evil, that will be a determining factor in all affairs. Chapter 3, verse 186. And peace unto you for that you persevered in patience.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, how excellent is the final abode? Chapter 13, verse 24. The Islamic Republic of Iran advocates and supports the camp of resistance. It advocates and supports the Palestinian resistance. We have always said this. We have always acted on this, and we have stood by it. We condemn the treacherous move to normalize relations with the Zionist regime. We condemn the policy of normalization of relations. Some Arab governments have asked the US to accelerate the matter of solving the Palestinian issue. If they mean that before the US leaves the region, it should remove any obstacle standing in the way of the Zionist regime, then, first of all, they have behaved treacherously and have brought disgrace to the Arab world. Secondly, they have been naive, since this is a case of the blind leading the blind. At the end of my statements, I send my greetings upon the souls of the Palestinian martyrs. I send my regards to their patient families. I send my greetings to the Palestinians who have been taken captive and prisoner, but who resist with a firm determination. I squeeze the hands of our resistant Palestinian groups who have undertaken to carry out an important part of this great responsibility. And I call on the entire world of Islam, in particular the youth, to participate in this field that brings dignity and honor. And our concluding call will be, all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Chapter 10, verse 10.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.